Welcome to PGR Matters. I'm your host, Matthew Sillins. The spring break has arrived, and as the campus is becoming quieter, I blocked out some time this afternoon to do some searching online about open research training. Microsoft's Copilot AI search, for instance, provides a list of several universities in the UK that offer structured programmes online or in person. I think it's pretty heartening to see how many options there are available for both postgraduate researchers and more established academics. Most of these, if I scroll down on the page there, most of these appear to cover topics we've already introduced in episodes 1 and 2 of this season, such as open access publishing and open licensing, data management and adherence to the FAIR principles, study pre-registration and reproducibility techniques. In this episode, our final in the Open Research series, we take a step back from these principles and priorities and try to understand how conceptions of openness are being reshaped, particularly for researchers in the arts, humanities, and social sciences. We also explore ways of learning about open research that are founded on gamification and consider what this has to offer to novice researchers who might be struggling to see how the open research agenda applies to their work practically. Our first interview is with Dr. Samuel Moore, lead researcher on the MORPHS project, a multi-institutional initiative with Dr. Jenny Adams and Professor Stephen Pinfield at the University of Sheffield, Dr. Miranda Barnes, Dr. Emily Roper, Dr. Valentina Bertolani at the University of Cambridge, Dr. Yannicka Adema and Dr. Rebecca Kiesewetter at Coventry University, and Dr. Siddharth Soni at the University of Southampton. MORPHS is funded by the UKRI Research England Development Fund, the Wellcome Trust, and the Arts and Humanities Research Council. In the course of our discussion, our guest challenges a number of the statements that have become core tenets of open research in the UK over the last 20 years. On first hearing this, it's tempting to question our engagement with the principles and practices that we've already covered in this season, questioning how open research is being discussed, performed, and valued, however, is not to outright reject it. Through our discussion, we can discern forms of openness that can happen, and are in fact are happening right now, is simply that these often fall outside the priorities of the discourse.
Fantastic to have you here, Sam. Thank you for making time, because I know you've been on a whirlwind of doing book promotions and also conferences in relation to the project that we're going to be talking about in a moment. But I think a lot of our listeners will probably want to know a little bit about you. So I'll ask you a bit in a moment about your academic origin story. But one of the things I do want to point out before we get started into this is that you did publish a book, which is open access. It came out in September 2025 with the University of Michigan Press, which is called Publishing Beyond the Market, Open Access, Care and the Commons. So I'm sure many people will be having a look, taking a deeper dive, I guess, into the structures that surround open access and open research work. So, but for today, maybe in your own words, you can say a little bit about your own academic origin story. So a little bit about where you came from, how you got into this line of work.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the invite. So I guess my academic origin story, which is quite a nice term, I've not really sort of heard about that before, heard that term before. But so I was a sort of humanities trained researcher, did a philosophy undergraduate, and actually at the University of Essex, which I still have a very soft spot for the department there. And then I did a master's in literature. So I was always steeped in that kind of thing, in humanities work. And then I subsequently, after my master's, I joined my first job was a publishing company called PLOS, which was a fledgling scientific publisher at the time. And they had developed this new model of open access publishing, which was very new at the time. And it was sort of it was going to change the future, and it was going to allow research to be free to everyone, and it was just this kind of really interesting, exciting time. And I joined that organization at a time of real rapid growth, and they were absolutely transforming the publishing industry. And a lot of what's happened since then, for better or for worse, was a result of PLOS and what they did, particularly things like the article processing charge. But then I thought, well, actually, I'm not really that interested in science. I don't understand any of the stuff I'm publishing. I'm just an editorial assistant. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go and do a PhD and just think about how open access publishing relates to the humanities and social sciences. And this was in sort of the mid-2010s, really, when I started it. And so I explored that question in King's College London in the digital humanities department. So I'm essentially a digital humanist. I don't really know what that term means. I still don't really know. I still call myself that, but I think about digital stuff from a range of different ways, I guess. And so I explored this question of like open access, looking at policies, how the policies impact our disciplines, and then how grassroots collectives sort of explore alternatives as well, which that was kind of like the PhD, which then that's what turned into the book, which was just published now. And so I had a very slightly strange career, I guess. I did the PhD, did some postdocing, some teaching fellowships, and then I joined Cambridge. And so my role at Cambridge is, I would say it's an academic role, in the sense that what I do is research-informed policy making and research-informed sort of behavioral sort of stuff like that, where I try to see like what's going on with open research, not just open access, but sort of open science, open research, and see how that relates to researchers at Cambridge. And so a lot of the stuff we do is sort of studies around the kinds of ways in which we publish there, or the impacts of certain policies like rights retention policies, and try to make the service that the university library provides to its academic quite research led. So I think I've got quite a unique position. I don't think there are many of me that exist in the UK, if not the world, which is quite interesting for me. And so I guess that's the story, really. And that's what takes me up to today. And the Morphs project, which I'll talk about, was really sort of situated in that we want to be able to stimulate behavioral change in AHSS subjects, and we do it in this research informed way, I guess.
Fantastic. That's really fascinating work. And I do think you're absolutely right. Yeah, there's not many of you in this world, I think, who are taking that kind of view of the ecosystem, maybe, and how it informs the policies and practices that we engage in universities. So you mentioned Morphs, which is we've mentioned already so far on the podcast, which is about materializing open research practices in the humanities and social sciences. That's the acronym. I'm from the University of East Anglia, which is often abbreviated to UEA, which is also known as the University of Excessive Acronyms. So I'm pretty familiar with them, and I think that one was a really good one. But do you want to explain to our listeners what the main aims of Morphs are as a project?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the acronym was even nicer when it was first designed. It was just going to be Morph, and the H was standing for humanities. But then social sciences sort of got involved as well, in a really great way. I mean, it was great that the funders were interested in broadening it out, but it was going to be the Morph project originally. But so Morphs, what we're trying to do is essentially explore how approaches to open research, which is often called open science, how that scientific understanding of openness has shaped how the various ways in which we practice it in the UK. So if you think about like the UK government's funding initiatives, the UKRI, for instance, they're very interested in open research. But if you read their statement about open research, it says often called open science. And then you see quite quickly afterwards that open science often refers to things like reproducibility, or data sharing, or rigor, transparency, all these things that actually do not really resonate that well with humanities and social science disciplines. And I say, and I lump those terms together, humanities and social sciences, knowing full well that there's a lot of quantitative social science that would be completely comfortable with those sorts of terms. But what we're doing is we're focusing on what you might call like the qualitative end of that spectrum, the critical theoretical traditions, rather than the more quantitative stuff. And so we're thinking that that the government narrative or the funder narrative or the institutional narrative, it's really led to disinterest or uninterest, I guess, but on the part of arts, humanities and social science researchers. They don't see themselves within that scientific framework. But we think actually that's not really good enough. We think that there are real reasons that our disciplines should get involved in openness, and they already are getting involved in it in many different ways. And we think that the best way to say to researchers, openness is good, this is a range of practices or a range of values that really conform to your disciplines. That's sort of what we're trying to do with the project. It's very much programmatic. It's about behavioral change. And so that's sort of the basis of it is we figure if we can reframe open science as open research or even open humanities, open arts or whatever, if we can reframe it and then we can give people lots of guidance around how to engage in these practices, then ultimately a better research culture will come out of that. We think that the openness has loads to offer for our disciplines, but it has to be framed in a way that is sensitive to them.
So from what you've described there, it sounds as though there are kind of issues around language, so the kinds of terms that are being used and how those, as you mentioned, sort of resonate with different communities of researchers. I guess scholarly communication is, you know, has a long history in a sense, because we could think of it in terms of scholarly communication pre-open access publishing or pre-open research in many respects. But maybe if I could just press you a little bit more to share how you came to focus particularly on this aspect of scholarly communication. So there's lots of different things that I suppose practices in academia that have been going on for a really long time. But why was it that open access was kind of the area for you?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually, because the idea really is that, you could ignore all this stuff like 5-10 years ago, but now you really can't ignore this. It's the kind of thing which, if you are working in a university in the UK right now, you have to do some form of openness. And open access is usually the way that people encounter open research. But if you're submitting for a funding application to someone like the Wellcome Trust, they will ask you to provide a data sharing agreement or a data sharing statement that says how you are going to share your data. If you don't think of what you're doing, your source material or whatever, if you don't think of it as data, then there's just a mismatch of language there. So I do think language is a really important thing, but I think it is more fundamental than just language. It's also actually these things have really come, there's a different genealogy that open science reflects and that has led to what we've ended up with now. And actually there's a ton of open research in the humanities and social sciences that firstly is being done already in quite mainstream places, secondly is being done at quite marginal places and could be done more, and thirdly we might be able to use some things that that really aren't being done at all and bring them in and make them for ourselves. So it's that focus of language, but actually the practice is really where it gets interesting, is that we don't want people to have to just blindly do a different practice. And you see that actually when you see qualitative researchers sort of having to write data sharing statements, they automatically think, oh, I should be sharing my data. I should be sharing my raw data files, my interviews and those sorts of things. And that really is kind of anathema to qualitative research. It's not something you just sort of blindly share. It's something that you work out how to share with various publics in various ways. It's a lot more nuanced than just here is my data, take it. And so that's the sort of stuff we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. I think what you've just mentioned there echoes some comments that were made by the head of open research at my own university back in episode one, where that there may be very, very good ethical protocols and reasons that have been followed for not sharing that information. You know, if there are human participants involved in it and there's particularly sensitive content, there are many cases.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt, but I think that's why I really hate statements like as open as possible, as closed as necessary, because they situate it in this they make people think that they have to make things open. There's a pressure to make things open, and there's a sort of a spectrum. We want things open as much as we can, but actually that's just not the best way of looking at it, because if you're a qualitative researcher dealing in human subject research, and you feel this pressure, and you think, actually, kind of everyone's telling me I need to share this data, so should I just share this data? And it might be completely inappropriate to do so, but it's that sort of pressure. And so rather than thinking about it as a binary or even as a spectrum of open versus closed, we're thinking about it in a much more exploratory way, where actually openness could mean something like how you open participation up to various people part of your research process, or it could mean openness to experimentation and those sorts of things. That to me is a more productive way of speaking to our disciplines.
Okay, thanks for that. And one of the things that you mentioned in your recent report, which was fantastic and really broadened my view, I suppose, in trying to take into account practices that actually, of course, are going on all the time, but not necessarily surfaced, perhaps, in quite the same way. They don't necessarily have the prominence, was the CARE principles. So we've been talking on this series so far about FAIR, about those FAIR principles as well, but we've also mentioned CARE. I mean, how did that kind of come into play with assembling the report that you've done recently? Is that something that you found helpful, I guess?
Yeah, so what we tried to do with the report is make a case for open research in the arts, humanities and social sciences, based not just on saying we disagree with a lot of what's happening, but also saying we've identified a range of practices that we are terming openness that are not traditionally part of what you might call like the open science canon or how we think about open research, or at least they don't find themselves within the policy sphere. So the UNESCO Declaration on Open Science does account for some of this sort of stuff, which is to say things like openness to alternative knowledges, indigenous knowledges, openness to collaboration, to different participation, and those sorts of things. But that just doesn't find itself as a priority within institutional frameworks. And it's that kind of thing which we don't think is particularly productive. And so with the CARE principle specifically, I mean, if you were to look at CARE is actually one way, if you're thinking about it in an open science perspective, from a sort of brute open versus closed, CARE is actually a way of closure, of keeping something closed, because a community says that actually we get to decide what to do with that. Now, we think actually that's the wrong way to look at it. CARE is a form of openness. It's a form of saying this is the community's work. This is something which we are kind of stewards of, and we want to ensure that participation is done in the best possible way with our community's norms and values in mind. And so that's it. It's openness to those participants, as long as those participants are respectful of your rules, of your cultures, and those sorts of things. And so that's you can think of it as a form of closure if you're thinking about it in an open science perspective, but it's actually a form of openness if you're thinking about kind of letting people in. And so a lot of what we think about is this idea of experimentation, or maybe openness to certain practices rather than openness of. Now, a lot of people now write about this. So Sabina Leonelli, her book on open science, is a fantastic argument in favor of moving away from what she calls a resource-based understanding of openness, where what the intention of openness is to share publications, to share data, to share code, all these sorts of things. And she says, actually, no, you need something a bit different. She argues for something called judicious connection, where you make different connections between different materials in order to generate more openness and such. And we say, actually, what we want is more experimentation, which is to say, we don't know the best way to bring stuff together, but we're pretty confident that collective approaches to knowledge production are really productive, and that experimenting in things like the form of the book, or experimenting in linearity, research presentation, all those sorts of things, that to me is that's the openness. So openness then becomes openness to, and that could be an openness to participation, to presentation, to all these various things, rather than openness of. And I think that's probably, if I was to say any conclusion like the top level conclusion from the report, I would identify that as being kind of the important one, because it really does shift how we think about openness. Because then when you're uploading your article to the institutional repository, as you're being told to do for ref purposes or whatever, you're not doing that because you're making it available to whoever. It's just not an indiscriminate thing. It's more of a collection of, why am I doing this? Why Who are the audiences who might access this? And then it starts to sort of percolate in different ways. And so if we can think about it in that openness two way, then it becomes a lot less homogenizing, I guess, and loads of things might happen from it. So it's a little bit theoretical, but I think there's some meat there which allows us to stimulate new practices. Yeah.
Great. Experimentation is exciting. I think that maybe we could just focus on that for a final point here, which is that this episode is looking at in many ways how we learn about open research and how we learn about open access. And we're going to be talking to somebody who's looking at gamification and different, in some ways, quite experimental ways of engaging with that as a training, as a form of training in academia. You mentioned that in your report. It's actually one of the recommendations, is to offer training on a diverse range of open practices. I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about what your team meant by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a diverse range of open practices would be the sort of stuff that I've talked about. So at the moment, training it tends to be open access, which is so important to everyone here, because of the government's policies on that. Open data is still an important thing. But then there's all these things around participation and experimentation that they're just not a feature of the training landscape at all. And I think that the idea behind MORPHs is like I say, is highly programmatic. And we think that if we want to change research cultures, then we want to be able to show researchers that this stuff is good, I guess, and it's worth engaging in. And so part of the project, I mean, I didn't mention this actually when I introduced it, but what we're focusing on now is a series of case studies where we are exploring these practices in more detail. So there's one about open peer review, and it's moving away from the idea that peer review can be either open or closed, and we're piloting things like collective approaches to peer review. And then we're also piloting approaches to social creation of books, like how different people can get together to create books. And so with these practices, what we hope to do is to say to people, what do you think? Is this the kind of thing that excites you, that stimulates you? Or is this actually, have we got it completely wrong and you just want to go back to publishing in exactly the same way? Which I mean, that probably will happen as well, which is completely reasonable. And one thing we are doing actually is this thing called the Unbind workshop. We've done one in the past in Cambridge, and the Unbind workshop brings together a bunch of scholars who are writing their first book, so probably some of the people who'll be listening to this podcast, and we say to them, this is kind of what openness is, we're really interested in openness, could you all give a presentation about what you would like to do with the book if you didn't have any kind of preconceptions around having to publish it as a book? Everyone's expected for their careers to publish a monograph in the way, or at least these scholars they have to publish a monograph for their career reasons. And so we asked them, if you didn't have to do that, how would you share your research? And it's all long form stuff, so it's still got a bookish quality to it. And they all had incredible ideas around like archiving, massive archives that people could immerse themselves into, or completely non-linear scholarship that you go over here in one way and then you go over there in another way and you explore it in a different way, or things like multimedia presentation, all this sort of stuff. And they've got these completely nuanced and defined ideas of what they want to do, but they can't do it because they have to publish a book that looks like a book. That's just how it is. And so we're saying, like, the training actually should allow people to experiment more with that, and to be able to take those thoughts and use them and see exactly what happens at the end of it. And so obviously there's a huge research culture angle to it. And so while we're telling people that we need to stop publishing in, I don't know, prestigious journals or high impact journals and those sorts of things, we actually want something that people can do instead. And we think that's the kind of thing, the experimental stuff, the stuff which you're not really supposed to do because it just takes up too much time, or there's no one supporting you to do it, or it's just hard to conceptualize. And so that's kind of where the training angle comes in. And that, I think, again, is a way to speak to our research communities, is to say, this is openness here. It's not data sharing and all this stuff. It's the stuff that allows you to really reconceive how you're producing and sharing knowledge.
Thanks very much, Sam. That's really thought-provoking. I'd be really interested to learn more about those case studies, and I'm sure many of our listeners will as well. Before we finish, it'd be good maybe for you to tell our folks where they can find information on the MORPHS project, because you've got a lot of outputs on what, you know, project deliverables, as they're known. And do you want to give us a quick signpost to those resources?
Yes, that's a good point, isn't it? So we have a website that's based on the Humanities Commons, or the Knowledge Commons repository. But the best way to find that would be if you just Google MORPHS, which is MORPHSS. And I'm sure it would come up that way. That's probably the easiest way of accessing it. But the Knowledge Commons repository is a fantastic place for academics to have their own kind of web pages. And then it's connected to a repository. So I love to sing its praises as well. So that's the best way of finding it. Just MORPHS is a pretty unique acronym, in fact, which is quite helpful. So, yeah.
It is indeed. Well, thank you for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure having this conversation, talking through and learning more about what you're doing with the project. And hopefully there'll be much more in the future coming our way. So have a great rest of the week, Sam, and thanks for joining us. Cheers.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Thanks.
In our second interview, we build on the previous point about experimentation and talk to Hannah Crago, Open Research Development Librarian at the University of Essex. Like Samuel Moore, Hannah's role has emerged from a deep interest in scholarly communication. Together with colleagues from her institution, she spent several years exploring and experimenting with play-based forms of learning. She's created teaching materials which have been licensed as open educational resources. Through our conversation, we consider why games have such resonance for researchers and how they can be expanded, developed as the landscape of open research evolves.
Hi, Hannah. Welcome back. Because I only saw you, a week ago at the at the University of East Anglia, when you came and led a Train the Trainers workshop on something called Copyright Dough, which we will get onto in the course of our conversation. But I just wanted to welcome you back virtually to UEA, and thank you very much for joining the PGR Matters podcast to talk more about learning, about open research. When I ask people onto the show, I normally ask them a bit about their academic or professional origin story, which sounds very grand, but I'm sure you've got a very interesting journey that you'd like to share with people. So how did you come to teach researchers about open research, kind of what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know how interesting origin story makes it sound a bit like I'm a superhero, but I'll explain kind of roughly how I got into open research. So I've been working on open research within our research services team at Essex since October 2019. So around 6.5 years now, which when I was thinking in advance of this, I had to calculate the years multiple times because I couldn't believe it had been that long. But I have done quite a few different roles in that time, which have had kind of varying levels of involvement with open research. So it has been a bit kind of in and out, I guess, a bit. The first role I had in what we call our academic and research services team here at Essex was information literacy coordinator, but my line manager at the time, Katrine Sinsbo, was our scholarly communications and research support manager, so she therefore kind of got me involved in lots of research support and open research activities, and I think the aim that Kat had to try to broaden the scope of that information literacy coordinator role to more kind of open research support, kind of helped me to get that job and put me in quite a good position to get it in the first place. Before that, I'd been working in our collections team, where I was responsible for interlibrary loans and digitising content for reading lists. And that area requires quite a lot of knowledge on copyright, mostly in terms of kind of copyright exceptions, educational licences like the CLA licence, that sort of thing. And that kind of copyright knowledge was transferable to the copyright elements of open research and things like Creative Commons licences, open licensing more generally. And so I think that stood me in quite a good position to move into this area. I'd also been studying for my master's in Library and Information Services Management at the University of Sheffield, part-time, kind of alongside my full-time job at Essex. And within that course, I'd completed a module on academic libraries, and I'd chosen to do my assignment for that module on open access. It was an area that already interested me. It was an area that was growing and an area that I was sort of learning a bit more about through my job in interlibrary loans and digitizations, and I thought it would be helpful to know more about it. And when I was doing that assignment, I went and spoke to Kat about her job, and she taught me more about how open access was just a small part of open research, and that kind of interest grew from there. So I think those two things helped me to get an interest in the area and get the job in the area. And then, yeah, so I was the information literacy coordinator less than a year into my time at that role. Kat got her way, I think, and the scope officially changed. The title changed to Scholarly Communications Coordinator. And then around 6 months after this, I was on secondment doing Kat's job while she was on maternity leave. So I was then managing our research services team. So I had to learn quite a lot quite quickly. But the really good thing with open research is it's a really rapidly changing area. So it feels a bit like everyone is always learning, no matter how long they've kind of been in those sorts of roles. And I think that's partly why I still love it and why it doesn't feel like I've been working in the area as long as I have. And I think it's also why teaching researchers about open research plays a part in most roles in that kind of area, because there's always something new to learn about open research. The scope of open research is always growing. And I think the MORFS report, which is the Materialising Open Research Practices in the Humanities and Social Sciences, I hope I've got that right.
Oh yeah, that sounds good.
Sounds right anyway. That was published quite recently. And I think that that report and the catalogue that's come out of that defines 30 different open research practices. And the focus of that report is only arts and humanities and social sciences. So that really kind of demonstrates how broad open research is and why those of us working in open research, we kind of have to be happy to train researchers a lot. We have to be happy to train ourselves a lot as well. But it's a part of the job that I really enjoy. And one of the reasons I've stayed in this kind of area, I think, I like to get other people enthusiastic about open research. So training researchers is a good way to do that.
Fantastic. Thank you, Hannah. I mean, you have definitely conveyed the enthusiasm and inspired me, because we wouldn't be doing this joint project with between the University of East Anglia and the University of Essex, and the funding from the Chase Doctoral Training Partnership on open research for the humanities if you hadn't been promoting and discussing and also publishing on the work that you've been doing. And also you mentioned Kat there, Kat Sunspo, who was your colleague in developing some fantastic resources, which we will come on into in just a moment. I was just thinking about something you said a few moments ago, which is about scholarly communication. And we're talking, and we have spoken to Dr. Samuel Moore, who is the lead researcher on the MORFS project. And I know you're off to the launch online in about 15 minutes straight after this interview. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be more revealed about MORFS in a moment. But scholarly communication, certainly from what Sam has been saying, is something that researchers and information professionals are kind of common ground, really, in a sense, because it's an area where they're both highly invested and enthused, but it's also kind of rapidly evolving and developing. And back in episode one, of this season of the podcast. Grant Young at UEA, head of open research at UEA, mentioned that this is, in a sense, a kind of opportunity, but it also poses a lot of challenges for novice researchers coming through and trying to navigate this ever-changing landscape around things like open access, which we talked about in the previous episode. So I guess my second question, which goes back to you and Kat, because you published open access, actually you published some work on gamification, and first of all, maybe if you could kind of define that a bit for us, for our listeners, but secondly, maybe in what ways has gamification been used by you and colleagues at the University of Essex? So a bit about definition and kind of then now, you know, how that's kind of manifested at Essex.
Yeah, so gamification as a definition, it's not something I've got immediately to hand, but I guess it's as you would expect, really, it's delivering training in a way that is kind of, I don't know how to say it without saying gamifying it, incorporating elements of fun and maybe kind of competitivity, but not always competitivity. Kind of playful learning is another way people describe it, gamification. And I think that something that we've found with it is that it takes people out of their everyday to kind of look at a problem in a different way. And that problem can be just needing to learn about something new, or it can be needing to navigate your way around a particular scenario. But by gamifying it, you're kind of making it almost a bit more manageable, I think, and making it seem something that isn't so high stakes, maybe. And you can kind of take a different approach to it. But yeah, gamification, playful learning, those sorts of concepts are how you kind of hear them discussed in the literature. And gamification is something we've incorporated into lots of elements of teaching and training at Essex for several years now. So when I first started working in the library as a graduate trainee back in 2016, for example, we were already using gamification through things like Lego-based referencing sessions. We ran scavenger hunt challenges for library inductions. We had a beach ball at some point that we used to throw around in information literacy sessions, but I really can't for the life of me remember how that worked. But I know it was fun, but also it was used in the training. So it's always been something since I've worked at Essex that has been kind of incorporated in different kinds of training for engagement and to kind of reach those learning outcomes in a different way and keep people interested in the topics. But I think it really took off at Essex in 2018 when Kat, who we've spoken at already, designed the Open Access Escape Room. And that was the first sort of full game rather than just a gamified element of training that was developed within our team. It was very much Kat's creation, though, so full credit needs to go to Kat for the Open Access Escape Room. Kat did include several of us in testing the game, and I was one of them, and that really helped me to learn more both about open access when I was at a stage of my career when it wasn't something I was overly familiar with, but also to learn more about gamification as a concept and sort of, rather than bringing small elements of gamification into sessions, using that as the whole concept of that training session. And I think through running the escape room, we all saw within our team how that sort of immersive game could really help make quite complicated or maybe lesser known concepts like open access was at the time, less so now, more accessible to researchers. It allowed those who we were teaching to, yes, as I kind of already alluded to, step out of their own sort of position and maybe the expectations that come with that, to really be someone else in the game. So it's an important concept when you're working with researchers, because researchers are used to being experts. They're used to knowing everything that they're talking about, what they're researching. And we know that PGRs, so postgraduate researchers especially, often struggle with imposter syndrome. And so asking these people who are used to being experts to learn about something that they maybe don't know anything about can be quite difficult or quite unsettling. preparing for them almost in a way. So if you give researchers an excuse to not know the answers by assigning them a new role, by making them step outside of who they are in their day-to-day, it can help them to sort of embrace the fact that they have a lack of knowledge if they're pretending to be a science student and they're actually a history academic, that they're apart from what they're used to. So that was a concept that Kat and I lent upon when we developed a new game after the Open Access Escape Room, which is called Copyright Dough. So this is the game that we played with you, Matthew, just a week ago. And it was also partly inspired by Chris Morrison and Jane Secker's game, The Publishing Trap. I'm not sure if you're aware of that one, but it's another open access game that is used to teach researchers about the publishing journey and scholarly communications more widely, I guess. And Kat and I had played The Publishing Trap with some of our researchers, and we'd found it worked really well. And because, like the escape room, the researchers took on different roles. So when we set about designing Copyright Dough, we knew we wanted to have a game where researchers had that permission to not know the answers. And that really leads to greater discussion in the game. I think people can kind of play devil's advocate almost by not having to feel like they're representing their own views. And that discussion is really pivotal to Copyright Dough. And we also really wanted an approach to teaching that allowed for a more memorable learning experience. People are much more likely, I think, to remember a training session where they've sat and created a Play-Doh penguin, maybe than one where a librarian has kind of just stood and spoken at them for an hour. And if you can remember the learning experience, you're more likely to remember the learning outcomes. So, and that kind of speaks to the final aim, really, which was we wanted to make copyright fun. We already thought it was fun. I like copyright. I think it's interesting, but sadly, not that many people do. So gamifying those kind of topics, the topics that maybe it can be difficult to get people through the door to training sessions on, can help break down those barriers in the first place. So, yeah, I think gamification works for quite a lot of reasons, and Copyright Dough really is just one example of that. But we found it to be a strong tool for teaching researchers, I think.
That's fantastic. I was just thinking as you were explaining the value of stepping into different roles, how when as a group we were playing Copyright Dough last Friday, and I was quite taken aback at how people, somebody I knew very well was in the room, I won't say who, and that person adopted a completely different persona when they were trying to defend their choices around the way they were using or creating and also essentially reusing content that other people had created. So actually thinking about the application of Creative Commons licensing and the particular license terms and how they apply in the real world, and what that means for the original creator, and what that means for the kind of secondary creator, I suppose, is the totally different kind of attitude, language, intonation, as you say, adopting a kind of, you know, almost devil's advocate position. So it's really stepping outside of their own personal preferences or ways of operating in the world. And I think that's really exciting to see, because I think all researchers do that to some extent, or encouraged to think in that way. So when they're starting out as a postgraduate researcher, often when we're running training sessions, we're talking about things they haven't encountered yet, so they don't yet know how they're going to respond in this particular situation in the future. So they're always kind of projecting forwards into this kind of scenario and a kind of a role that they might adopt. So sometimes it might be, you know, a researcher who's on field work. So they're a field researcher. So what would they be like in a particular community? Then they might be a writer. They might be an author. They're publishing a journal article, or maybe, you know, one day they're publishing a monograph or something else, you know, a book chapter, some kind of contribution. Another time they're a conference presenter. They're actually presenting their work. And in each of these situations, they adopt different behaviors, and they have to read the room, sometimes quite literally in a conference, and make choices about what they're going to say next or do next. And that's what I really loved about Copyright Dough as an experience, is they really brought that to the forefront of people's minds and thinking, actually, yeah, maybe I do need to reflect a bit more on how I engage with these ideas and this kind of situations. So great. That was very, very powerful. And there's some brilliant penguin, Play-Doh penguin pictures as well that we had from it. So
thank you. Oh, sorry, I was just gonna say, yeah, no, it's really great to hear that it resonated that way in the with the roles and things. And I think I know who you're talking about, and I would agree. They embrace the different roles, which is exactly what we want people to do with Copyright Day. So it was really great to see. And I think it does help. And I think also with researchers, those kind of roles work particularly well, because you can be one of those one day and one another. So the way the game works, we have students, teachers, researchers, and creators. And for most researchers, they have been students. They may still be students if they are PGRs. They are researchers. They are likely to be, if they're not already, teachers as well. And they are also creators. So they kind of have experience, or will have experience, of all of those roles. And I think appreciating that you can be one of those one day and one the next, and seeing things from all of those different points of view is quite powerful in a way. It's a different kind of perspective of looking at things. But yeah, it works well for copyright because of the way they are, the different layers of research work, and the way the copyright licenses affect reuse and things. But I think it's a concept that could work in different areas of scholarly communication as well.
Fantastic. Resources that you've created for Copyright Dough, we don't have a video for this episode, but if I were to just walk over to my cupboard here, I've got a whole stack of Play-Doh over here and a load of laminated cards and information sheets and things like that. We've printed for our training session that we're going to be running very soon, but I could easily get hold of that material because it was available online. I didn't need to actually ask you to send me the material over. It was hosted on, I think it was Figshare, which was the kind of resource sharing platform or repository. And so for all intents and purposes, this is an open educational resource, which actually falls under, funnily enough, in a very meta way, falls under the kind of rubric of open research, really. So open educational resources, OERs, are one area of practice, I guess, that universities can engage in. So can you tell us a bit more about the way that this resource has been licensed, and how similar resources actually influenced your work and the work that Kat did?
Yeah, absolutely. So Copyright Dough, like you say, is an OER. It's shared on Figshare under a Creative Commons Attribution license, so a CCBY license. And what that means is that others can reuse the work, including remixing, building upon, distributing, all of those sorts of things. And all they need to do is give attribution to Kat and I as the copyright holders, and in this case also the creators of the game. And we deliberately chose that license for a few different reasons. Firstly, we do want people to be able to reuse the game, but we want them to be able to reuse it in a way that works for them and for their researchers. So we want them to be able to create variations on the game if that's what they want to do. We included in the materials on Figshare some blank cards, for example, so people could write in their own roles, their own task scenarios, those sorts of things. So they might be quite small tweaks that people could make to the game. But also we'd be happy for people to create wider variations on the game as kind of just reusing the concept of it, but to teach a completely different topic. You could use the kind of premise, but not necessarily to teach about copyright licenses. So that's why we kind of wanted to use, as one of the reasons, we wanted to use a quite open license there with the CCBY. And we have had some people at other institutions tell us that they have made variations of the game or done some tweaking, played it slightly differently, that sort of thing, which is exciting and is a massive compliment as well. So we wanted that reuse and adaptation to be possible. And we also wanted to practice what we preach around openness. So like lots of institutions, we encourage our researchers to make all elements of their work, not just the final outputs, as open as possible and as closed as necessary. So that's sort of how we approached it. We thought, how open do we want it to be? And how closed does it necessarily need to be? We didn't think there was a particular reason to add a NC or non-commercial layer. We didn't think there was a reason to add a no derivatives ND layer. So we didn't. We thought about the different licenses and what that would mean for us. And we were happy with CC BY. But we also did want that attribution element. We didn't want to completely openly license it CC0. I think attribution is really important, especially when you put quite a lot of work into something. Plus, it is always nice to see or hear that other people are using the work. And it's opened up some conversations with colleagues where we've seen it cited or they've emailed us maybe to say we're using it, that sort of thing. And then we could chat to them about it and what they're doing with it. And it's good for kind of building relationships and links with other people who are maybe also using gamification in their training in different ways. You asked also about kind of similar resources, and I've mentioned a few of these already. So specifically Open Access Escape Room and the Publishing Trap, both of which are openly available online. I think that the Escape Room is CC BY. I think that the Publishing Trap might be BYNC, but they are both openly licensed. And the Open Access Escape Room is also hosted on Figshare. That the way Kat had already shared the Escape Room, we did quite similarly with Copyright Do. And I think Figshare is quite a accessible platform. It's quite easy to use from a user point of view. If you were considering sharing something openly, it's easy to use. You get a DOI for your work and you can kind of pull things together in projects. And so Copyright Do is a project where each of the individual resource material has its own DOI, but it pulls it all together. The Escape Room and the Publishing Trap are both really great games. Encourage you to have a look at those as well on Figshare. But I think a point I wanted to make about the kind of OER element of Copyright Do and other OERs, one thing that was important for us to include alongside the cards and things that you mentioned, Matthew, that you've printed and used, is we've got instructions there for running the game and instructions for the facilitators. And I think it's quite a subtle but important point with OERs and also with any openly licensed content more generally, really, because these resources need to be reusable practically as well. So not just in terms of the license allows you to reuse them, but the person who finds and downloads or is using that material needs to know how to use it. Otherwise, it's just a set of cards that you don't know what to do with. So that's important for OERs. It's important for things like open data, open code, lots of different elements of things that are being shared openly. If you want people to be able to reuse them, reproduce them, adapt them, those sorts of things, having that kind of relevant, depending on the context, supplementary materials, in this case, just some instructions of how to play the game, are really helpful. I think that's kind of another part of the accessible nature of open that needs to be kept in mind, that kind of making it possible, not just license terms wise, but practically to reuse content.
Thanks, Hannah. That's a really, really fascinating point there, and I think really important one to remember, because the Open University, unsurprisingly, has done an open research module online, which I think is also licensed under a Creative Commons license. And as I was working through those materials in the last sort of couple of months or so, I came across an interesting analogy that they use in their training, which is about baking competitions or sort of baking challenges, where, you know, online someone might say, you know, here's a cake. You know, it's kind of perfection, beautifully iced. It's supposed to, in one form, they take a photograph of it, they put it on, you know, Instagram or something. And lots of people look at it, and then, you know, along with that, there is a challenge to create that cake, and you might provide maybe a list of the ingredients, but that's it. So there's no method mentioned with the recipe there. It's just a list of ingredients, and then, you know, people go away and they labor in their kitchens and bring these things out of the oven, they ice them, and then they send pictures back in on social media, and they look absolutely nothing like the original cake. So yeah. the point being that actually, you know, the elements can be there, all of the things that you're, you know, the raw data or the resource, in this case the OER, but without the instructions, it's extremely limited in terms of what you can do, or at least what you get at the end of it is going to be quite different. And I think we talked about that a little bit with Grant in episode one, how, as you mentioned open data a moment ago, and how things like data dictionaries can really help people understand the kind of structure and the layout of the data set. And I guess how, you know, things like, you know, you've provided printing instructions, for instance, of how to print the game out on a, you know, a non-commercial printer.
Yeah.
Which is really helpful, and I'm sure I've did it wrong anyway, but I think it's still, you know, really helpful to have that, because if somebody is printing at home and they just want to, you know, do some copies on paper and, you know, color copies, they want to be able to cut those up at the right size, they want to be able to use them effectively in the you know, whilst playing the game. So not only have you got those, you know, great instructions of how to play, but also you've got the instructions of how to actually manifest it in the physical world. A little bonus question, I suppose, for you, which we haven't agreed, but is something that you mentioned last week when you visited UEA, was about the online version of the game. Because during the pandemic, obviously we're talking about, we're sort of, I guess, implying that these sessions are all physical, but that wasn't always the case, was it? You did have different ways of running games at that point in time.
Yeah, we did. It's a sorry tale. Kat and I had just finished putting together the game. We'd kind of run some tests with it, and we were booked into two, I don't know, maybe three different conferences to take the game to play. And then it was a global pandemic, everything shut down, could not attend those conferences. But one of the conferences shifted online, and they asked us if there was any way we could run it online. And we had no way to run it online, but we came up with one. And we created an online version of Copyright Dough, which we went on to run with some of our researchers during the pandemic. And it ended up being quite a nice way to engage people more with training through the pandemic. It feels a long time ago now, but you'll remember after several months of online training, more and more cameras were being turned off, more and more people were kind of not engaging with you in these online sessions. And so running Copyright Dough online gave us a way to get that engagement back a bit in some online sessions. We couldn't call it Copyright Dough. There was no Play-Doh involved, unfortunately.
Yeah.
instead of asking in Copyright Dough, all the people playing create Play-Doh models, and then they are licensed under a Creative Commons license, and discussion ensues of whether the reuse is permissible or not. So instead of creating Play-Doh models, we used the whiteboard feature on Zoom for people to draw their creations rather than creating them out of Play-Doh, because quite an important element of the game is that you have to be able to be inspired by or copy other people's models. So we needed everyone to be able to see the drawings as they were happening. So we had the whiteboard divided up into a grid with people drawing in their section all at the same time. And
that's exciting.
We were kind of sending them links to their pack of cards that would open into a box folder that they could view just their cards and not everyone else's cards. And it was a bit of a logistical headache, but we got it to work, and it was quite rewarding in the end. And we did have some people came along, enjoyed it, I think, got people chatting, discussion still happened online. So it just shows that you can bring gamification to lots of different types of training in lots of different ways, and the fundamental kind of playful learning, as we mentioned earlier, can still translate, even if it's not quite in the exact same way as you might have originally thought. So yeah, it was fun. It was a different way to think about it, and it kind of made us reflect on what are the key parts of the game and the gamified learning that we wanted to maintain, even if we couldn't keep the exact method of playing the game, I guess.
Wow, great. Well, the good news is, I mean, although that was a fantastic adaptation, I suppose, or kind of evolution in the history of Copyright Dough, we are going to be playing it again in person, and I think there is a kind of, there's a value to the tactility of it. So there's something about, you know, physically making a three-dimensional object, which I think really captivates people. It's like, sort of, you know, people lean into their creative side a bit more, and it sort of also lends itself to some pictures, which I think is actually, not to give too much away, but is, you know, occasionally part of the game is taking photos. So it sounds very exciting. I know you've done some publications, you've got some information out already, partly with Kat as well. Where can people find out more about the kind of work that you've been doing at Essex?
Yeah, so you can find all the Copyright Dough materials on Figshare. If you look up my Orchid profile, then it's all linked there as well, along with the publications that Kat and my current colleague Liam Bullingham have written about gamification more broadly. Mm-hmm. You can follow me on LinkedIn, or connect with me on LinkedIn rather, I don't follow you. There's resources and things shared on there. I'm always happy to talk about it as well. So if anyone wants to drop me a message, I'm happy to hear from them. But yeah, the publications, including the Copyright Dough materials, probably the easiest way to find them is through my Orchid profile.
Excellent. Thank you, Hannah. It's been a joy seeing you again, learning more about the history of Copyright Dough and your other activities. And we'll be catching up again very, very soon online. When we're doing our training sessions, and also thinking about how there can be another stage in the evolution of Copyright Dough, I guess, and how we might work with postgraduate researchers to create new resources and my extensions to the game system. Thanks for your time. I do hope you enjoy the Morph's launch as well this afternoon, and
thank you.
And have a great rest of the week, and looking forward to catching up very soon.
Thank you, and thanks very much for inviting me along. It's been a really great series so far, so I look forward to hearing the conclusion of it.
That's it for episode 3 of season 2 of TGR Matters. I hope you found the conversations around the principles of open research, the forms of open access publishing and licensing, and this episode's focus on open research training engaging, particularly if you're a postgraduate researcher from the arts, humanities, and social sciences. If you'd like to learn more about the training program funded by the Chase Doctoral Training Partnership, check out my website at matthewsillence.org for my latest blog post on this topic and links to resources as part of this initiative. Finally, I'd like to say thank you to all of our contributors so far this season: Grant Young, Sean Anderson, Alison Barker, Sean Seeger, Sam Moore, Hannah Crago, and to you, the listeners. If you would like to get in touch about the podcast, you can contact me at pgrmatters@pm.me.